Hi, everybody. This is CJ Wilson joining you with Josh Olsiewicz, and we are going to record another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. Today, we're talking about how the sausage is made internationally, why there's no pivot coming to save us, and how fast food could be the real big winner going forward, because it seems like no one's qualified to do anything else. Josh, we were talking in the pre-show a little bit about really the curtain and how I think a lot of people are seeing how this all works, how everything works. Tell me a little bit about what you think about what's happening with Jerome Powell and the Fed.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is generational too. We, since I've been born, right, 88, we've mostly had low rate environment or zero rate environment. And now is not that time. Now is very different than any other time we've had in history. At least since inception for me, since birth, right? So a lot of people are still coming to the realization that the Fed has a ton of power, more so than I think people my generation even realized, because they're still optimistic every time there's a meeting that things are going to go our way, things are going to reverse course, and risk assets are going to get saved. And that's just not the case. It's not the case. And in the US, interest rates still rising, continue to rise, unlikely to reverse course anytime soon, unlikely that anything explodes anytime soon that matters, right? You can point to various sectors, housing, or what else is blowing up right now? Bonds in the UK, I don't know. Like there's little fires everywhere, but there's no like giant explosion, you know? So until we get that, then maybe things will change. But right now, it's just status quo.
What's really interesting to me is that in the global financial crisis in the sort of 2007 to 2009, like the run up and burst and kind of slammed down, the total amount of stimulus was about $850 or $880 billion dollars that the American government kind of used to prop up banks that they deemed as too big to fail. The banking industry is obviously a huge industry in America, but it's also big because it's tied to all these other international interests, right? So the dollar, the euro, the pound, the Japanese yen, these are kind of the big, I guess you would call them like the trade currencies, right? That a lot of us are seeing money flow back and forth because of where people are, you know, taking out debt, where people are building things, stuff like that. But there's no Federal Reserve Bank or central bank or whatever that's really like in a perfect spot. They're all kind of propped up against each other. And because of that, it's like, I try to explain it like this, like legs on a table, right? So when all of them are strong, then the table's flat and there's not really a lot of fluctuation in the currency prices, you know, on a day-to-day basis or week to week. But we've seen like the euro and the pound get super devalued as a result of maybe regulatory fears or something like that. So people are just like literally pulling money out of some of those countries and some of those bonds, or, you know, I guess Federal Reserve notes or Treasury notes or whatever. And they're sticking them in dollars, which is kind of in a way making America seem like it's a stronger place to put money. But at the end, but like you said, the housing market right now, which has always been like a big chunk of the overall picture for financial, you know, the overall financial picture in America, it's getting super wobbly. You're seeing decelerations, less people are buying houses. The cost to close basically is, and the monthly cost of that same house today is like twice what it was 2 years ago, because interest rates are so gnarly and the value of the house went up. So at some point, yeah, you do think that there is going to be like a cataclysm, that some industry is going to snap and break the way the banking industry did with some specific failures. But in a way, like, people are still in the market. It doesn't matter. Like, it almost doesn't matter how bad it is. It's, and how thorny all these investment theses are for this short period of time. Everybody thinks we're close to something, like every day is one day closer to the pivot, right? And right. That's the hope that people have. But I don't know. I just see the collective pain. It's just collective pain everywhere. Like everywhere you turn, whether it's crypto or whether it's, you know, I don't know, art, or what's the safe investment right now? Everything's off the top. There's nothing that's coming up other than the dollar, right?
Yeah. None of this is really like the levels that it's at, you know, if you look at mortgage rates or just Fed fund rates, none of it is like the rate that it's at. It's the rate of change that we had mm-hmm. over the past few months, right? Even in the same with the stimulus stuff, which maybe we didn't realize at the time, certainly some people did, but just injecting that amount of money into the system all at once, we're feeling those effects now with inflation. We felt those effects, and now they're raising rates, and now we're feeling those effects extremely quickly, and that's having an impact on everything, and it touches everything. Inflation touches everything. So they are laser focused on inflation, mm-hmm. which means you're going to see high unemployment. You're going to see housing mortgages evaporate, as in there's going to be very few being issued, right? Because rates are going to be like 10% or whatever it is. Auto loans are collapsing, you know, consumer debt is at an all-time high. Like, none of this stuff is good, but it also indicates that we're still in the churn and the chop, you know, we're not there yet. Like you said, we're getting closer to the end, mm-hmm. but we're not there yet.
So inflation, and what I mean by inflation is, let's say the Federal Reserve rate hikes, right? So inflating the actual the rates, the lending rates, it in a way it sort of applies a tourniquet to like runaway costs. At least that's the idea, right? So they're saying, oh, we have to keep raising rates because that will somehow slow demand and that will decrease the inflation, which is causing pain and problems to people. But I think it's crazy to see how it's such a topic for people that have really didn't have a concept of it before, right? And you and I are talking about it because we're obviously like, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, like Bitcoin libertarians or something, where we think like, oh, hey, you know, it's because of this, that, and the other thing. But it just shows how systemic the sort of financial oligarchy is, right? If you have a person or a group of people, a small group of people that can manipulate a global economy, right? Whether it's good or bad, I mean, their intentions can be good, right? But the pain is felt collectively by a couple billion people at a time. It's just kind of like, it's like, hey, this is what we've been warning you about, and this is what happens. And better or worse, like, do you like this system? Is this a good system? And that's where the Bitcoin people are like, aha, I told you so. This is a bad system. And now it's coming home to roost and it's showing. And then, you know, but obviously Bitcoin's not at an all-time high. So that's the weird thing, is that like, we were right about everything except for the price of Bitcoin when all this stuff starts to get wacky. So what changes? Like, what's the next step?
Yeah, and well, Bitcoin worked in a sense that when they made more money, when more money entered the system, when they printed a bunch of money, price went up, right? Mm. To me, it says, hey, that works. When money got taken out of the system, as is happening now, you can look at like year over year change of M2, for example. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. Everything's losing value. We're taking liquidity out of the system. What's important now is, as we're still taking liquidity out, as tech is collapsing, as you know, metaverse is down more than in Bitcoin on the year.
Not the metaverse,
the company. The company. Sorry, Meta, the company.
Meta, the company. Yeah.
But what's important now is the decoupling, or the appearance of a decoupling, the appearance of narrative shifting, where all the like FOMO, euphoria, day trader people seem to have been washed out. And everyone who's left is just like, yeah, okay. They're fine with, it seems like they're fine with the price, right? We're seeing an all-time high in the amount of coins that haven't moved in the past year. It's like at 68%. Mm-hmm. So the people that are here are just like, yeah, okay, game on, right? Now that may change if we drop another 5,000 whatever dollars, but in the moment, tech is getting slaughtered, whereas we are flat. We are up, you know.
But tech is getting slaughtered because they had, you know, price to earnings ratios of like 50-1 for a while, yeah. Right? Or more. Yeah. And I think this is one of the problems with, let's say, the SPAC, you know, craze and some of these other things, is so many people were in a rush to go public so they could liquidate shares and so they could get liquidity. Because that was the exercise. That was the whole point of being a venture capitalist, was to build a company up, get some crazy valuation, get it listed, take a bunch of money off the table. And then it's like, but what is the actual product? Is there revenue in this company? Is there, and it's like I think Nikola is the company that was like building electric trucks apparently. And they had this video, and then the guy just got convicted for fraud. Cause they're like, yeah, well, we just sort of like, we filmed this thing and the truck was actually just rolling downhill. It wasn't actually powered at all. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, how did nobody blow the whistle on this? But, you know, on this company, because people want to be the next whatever. That's the narrative. And the narrative is, hey, this is the next Uber. This is the next Facebook. This is the next Nike. This is the next Tesla. But those narratives, I mean, they sell you a story, but that's not factual, right? And so I think people, when the curtain comes up and you see how the sausage is made, and you see that there's these meetings with these people that decide these things, and that affects the CPI, which affects, you know, senior citizens, and it affects commercial real estate, you know, like rent increases and stuff like that. All of a sudden you're like, wait a second, this dude that I see on TV right now, it's kind of like Fauci. When Fauci was talking about the COVID stuff at the beginning, people were like, wait, how is this one guy running this whole type of umbrella of things? And now they're seeing Jerome Powell. And this is for people that are younger like us that didn't have to experience bank problems in 1980 or 1987 or something like that. We weren't like participating in that market. I was born in 1980, but I wasn't like, yo, man, this inflation sucks. I didn't have any, I was, you know, goo goo gaga. So, now we're just at this point where people have hope that every day that goes by that you can sustain, you could hold the pain, is just you're closer to a pivot, and that eventually that's going to be the gas pedal for risk on and things are going to go up again. But we're still the prices for so many things are still so high from where they were when they're making sense. Like you said, we're decoupling from tech because tech didn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't need 50 versions of a Uber Eats or, you know, five scooter companies. Like we don't.
Five. I think that's just Austin. I think just in Austin, Texas, there's five scooter companies, you know.
That's fair. But the market, yeah, we're cleaning a lot of that out. But really the inflation hits the people who aren't in the markets the hardest. Because like you said, they have to pay, you know, higher groceries, higher rent, higher everything, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's who this is trying to help.
But are companies benefiting from this though? Because this like, you know,
it's like a Swedish death cleaning, you know.
Oh, I like Swedish death cleaning. You gotta yeah. You gotta define that for me.
Yeah. So okay. Like, if somebody in your family dies, or like a Marie Kondo type deal, you know, we're getting rid of all of the chaff. We're mm-hmm. separating the good from the bad, the efficient from the inefficient, cleaning it all up. You know, that's what's happening.
But that's the way markets are supposed to function, right? I mean, that's the idea. That's the concept of people that are free market economists. They say, you know, the market itself will shake out the players and the winners and the losers, right? The market will determine based on market fit. If you have a good company, people will gravitate towards your company, right?
So, yeah, but we just let that, you know, we had it on 11 for so long that so many companies snuck by. Mm-hmm. Without being punished for it, and mm-hmm. now that's what we're seeing. So it is the free market, but at the same time we let it get out of control, we being the Fed, honestly. And they should have done way more sooner. They should have done less in the stimulus department. Mm-hmm. Many people were telling them that, but
well, when the Bitcoiner type people or the Austrian economists or the, let's say, the fiscally conservative, you know, broad stroke, everybody fiscally conservative says, hey, when you print these trillions of dollars and you put this into the system, it's going to be really bad. We don't know how far the can's going to get kicked down the road, but when the can stops like being kickable because it's disintegrated or whatever, like the pain at the end will be really, the longer it goes, the worse. So right. We're effectively, let's call it like, I mean, what is it technically, 30 months past like the massive injection? Because I think it was like March, April, or maybe it was April, May, something like that. So we're 2.5 years past like when it all kind of started going into the system, like at speed, from when the ramp just kind of went vertical. And here we are. So 2 years later, this is the pain we've got. The interest rate is what, quadrupled or something like that, maybe.
Yeah. That's
you know, so it's like the effects of a credit based economy like we live in, where there's $90 trillion in debt, you know, between everybody, personal credit cards, corporate debt, government debt. And then there's only like $9 trillion in the money supply. Like that's a very wacky ratio, and things are starting to kind of like, it's like thin ice that starts to crack, and the cracks start to, you know, spread out in new cracks. And we sort of don't know what's going to happen next, but someone's going to, at some point, someone's going to fall through.
Well, that's the argument for the inability to raise much higher than 5%, because mm-hmm. our own interest payment, our own
government
debt interest payments, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exceed like anything we can even think about paying. Like it would be the single biggest line item other than like the defense budget. And it might even
It'll exceed that, because if you get to the point where we're at $30+ trillion of debt, and if that $30+ trillion costs a trillion and a half per year to service, then that's crazy expensive. You know, that's what the issue is. So because our GDP is only like $3 trillion a year.
Yeah. Right? So we have to inflate it away. Like, what else are we going to do? We're not going to have austerity. That's not going to happen. No one's going to get elected on austerity.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, you know? No, you're right. Austerity is not an electable platform for politicians. And that's,
you get elected on spending money, and you don't worry about what happens 10 years from now. You worry about what happens from when you're elected to 2 years after. Right. Mm-hmm. So I just saw yesterday they're talking about broadly in the U.S. paying for $13 billion in aid to help American families lower energy bills. And yeah, I love that. Sounds great on the surface, but again, we're spending money to pay for stuff. It's another stimulus type of activity where that's not going to help inflation, you know, right?
Right. So I was listening to a podcast the other day, and someone was talking about like the cost of energy itself, like how much it costs to, let's say, build a natural gas power plant or a nuclear power plant or something. So just so we all kind of, because people throw around millions, billions, trillions, but like at scale, it's important to understand what all that means. So this is factually accurate as of like, let's say, November 1st, 2022. To build a nat gas power plant is fairly cheap, right? To build a nuclear power plant is fairly expensive. But the scale at which it costs to build solar or wind power, right, is like 10 to 25 times as much. And it's like intermittent. So in the UK, for instance, they've spent $500 billion on solar and wind infrastructure. Okay. It's like $5 to $7 billion to build a nuclear plant. So if you think about that, right, and it, like, it's crazy, $5 to $7 billion for a nuclear plant, and you need probably 3 nuclear plants, maybe 4 nuclear plants for all of the UK. That's it, because the amount of power you can produce, you know, whereas they've spent $500 billion. So it's just the scale of the mistake of doing like the forward projection of like, hey, a credit card and what the credit card interest is. And that's the way I like kind of try to explain it to people. If you buy the thing and you take the pain or the austerity of saving up for it and buying it all at once, you get the benefit and then you get to depreciate it, you know, from like a taxable basis. But if you continue to pay credit service on it and you do interest only payments or whatever, which is effectively what our budget is, which is why we have a $30 trillion debt or deficit, you know, in that regard as a country. If you don't pay for the right stuff at the right time, then you pay it 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much down the road or more.
Right.
And so this energy stimulus thing could actually be solved by just building power plants. And we have enough natural gas in America that you could build power plants kind of anywhere. We have coal, obviously it's dirtier from a lot of standpoints, but it's also simple and it's
coal's hard. Bad. Let's not do coal.
Coal's so bad.
We just need to get used to nuclear, you know?
Right. Right. And so, but back to this again. So for $7 billion, you can build a nuclear plant. So then the question is how many people can, and what kind of radius can that nuclear plant solve, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of a power need. And then what does that mean in terms of energy costs and like, what's the amortization schedule for that? Right. Cause I look at it very simply that if at some point, and now here's the thing, like private wise, you can get a license to build a power plant, a coal power plant, or a nat gas power plant, or a wind farm, or whatever. Like a regular person could get, you know, qualified for that through the process, just like you have to jump through some hoops for regulation, but it's not that hard. But to do a nuclear plant, you have to have a whole nother level of clearance and all that stuff, because you're dealing with, like, you know, uranium and whatever else. So
the mistakes kind of last generations, right?
Right.
So that's appropriate.
Right. But then there's also, like, the scale again of, like, how much material is actually required. Like, how much, like literally a thimble full of uranium produces how much energy versus, like, how many barrels of oil, or, you know, how many cubic feet of gas or whatever there is. So I just think that's where we do a really poor job as a government, you know, meaning American government, of, like, spending money on the right stuff at the right times. Because if they would have built out the power structure in terms of, like, actual nuclear plants, then we wouldn't have energy crisis, you know, problems. We wouldn't have energy shortages, because you'd have abundant energy, right?
I mean, you had Chernobyl, you had Fukushima, you had Three Mile Island. That's what people see when they think of nuclear. That's
right.
That's the issue.
Right. But at the end of the day, like, those haven't been cataclysmic to the earth. They've been, there's people that, you know, die, but there's more people that get, like, that die and slip and falls than, you know, get injured with guns or something like that, right? So there's, like, all these statistics that you can lie about if you have an agenda, right? And you could say, oh, there's this many people, there's this many excess deaths, there's this many, you know, climate emergency things, there's this many car accidents. And you could sort of make a case to say, you know, oh, if one life is lost, then it's too many, right? But at the end of the day, there's billions of people on the earth. So we have to think about, like, protecting the energy infrastructure for people, like, hundreds of years in the future. And, you know, that's where I, like, when I heard that stat about $500 billion spent on solar and wind, and then it's like, wait, $7 billion to build a nuclear plant. I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You could build 50 nuclear plants, like, for, and still come out ahead. That's crazy. You know? And I think, but that's where we're at. The fear is
yeah, I mean,
getting
it's
there.
The perceived risk. Certainly. Right. It's the NIMBYism, you know, I don't want it in my backyard.
Right.
It's the memories of, you know, kind of this bias against the inefficiencies, maybe that things have gotten smaller, things have gotten more efficient in the nuclear side of things. But right. I don't see how, as a civilization, we don't like collapse unless we have nuclear, you know,
right?
We can't keep pumping carbon and methane into the atmosphere.
Well, we need clean water and we need clean energy, right? So yeah. Clean has different definitions. Everybody agrees what clean water is, right? That's water without lead, water without arsenic, water without pollution, water without, like, you know, but they see the
bacteria,
the plastic patch in the Pacific Ocean or something like that. And it's like, right. Okay, we need to clean that up. It's like, okay, that makes sense. Everybody gets behind that. No one's out there going, dude, the ocean doesn't, no, we should make a super dirty ocean. It should be mud water everywhere. Like, no, everybody agrees that, like, clean water is good. But I think clean power is not something that people really get into. They don't really understand it because it's not marketable. It's like an apple. Like, you don't, like, someone gives you an apple and you know it's healthy because it's like a fruit, grows on a tree, all this other stuff. But there's no one, like, trying to sell you the apple. Whereas, like, Oreo cookies, people are trying to sell you the Oreo cookies because you're like, oh, it's, like, sugary and chocolatey and, like, da 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 da.
Well, you need co-investment and you need transition periods because there are people who have, you know, coal jobs, right? There aren't that many anymore, but there are
right. Certain
sectors of the United States, abroad, wherever else, right?
Yeah,
They need employment, right? They can't just learn to code and figure it out. You know, they
sure.
need to transition. And that's where I think, like, Bitcoin mining, like we talked with Daniel Batten about methane, you know, hooking up the manual labor involved,
yeah.
that sort of thing.
And I thought that was great. But I think, like, we're still a society that requires goods and services, right? And I think when you balance out too high on services, then you have, it's way easier to disrupt that with demand and stuff like that. Whereas with goods, you know, goods, like durable goods, food, clothing, I don't know, whatever. When you're producing that type of stuff, people are needing that at a different level than they are services, because you can appify a service and then sort of, it's not needed anymore that someone's going to physically help you with that. Whereas, like, you can't really appify dinner in a way that, like, somewhere there is raw material going into a pot, stirring it up, heating it up, putting salt in it, and then it's food, right? So and I'm using this as a funny transition, but, like, Subaru just wrote this article in Auto Week that they're having a hard time retaining employees at their factory in Indiana. They're experiencing record profits as a company, but they can't keep people because they're saying that literally people are quitting to go work at McDonald's. which I think is funny, because obviously you would think the brain power required to build a car versus the brain power collectively required to flip burgers, you know, on time and hand them to people, that those are two different things. But like literally you're seeing people say, you know what, this hard job is too hard and I can make almost the same money, you know? So well, people are like, it's like a brain drain. People are willingly going to do an easier job because the marginal increase in value isn't there for them. And, you know, you were saying that there's companies that are like freezing hires and there's other people that can't hire enough people, but then so it's just like, we're seeing a split on things that we used to think are correlated, meaning like stock buybacks, and profit. And now it's like hiring freezes and stock buybacks. And it's like, wait, what, how is that?
So, I mean, every day, I thought last month and the quarter prior, we saw a lot of layoff announcements. But every day this week, you know, it was Apple, it was Amazon. They're either doing hiring freezes. I saw Lyft. I saw Stripe, which is a payment processor. Everybody's laying off 14%, 20%. Twitter's laying off 3,700 people. You know, that's more Elon related, but that's everywhere. Google as well. Looks like they have a hiring freeze. So all this stuff is going on in tech. And like you said, we have this like wage price spiral a little bit going on in services. I saw an article out of Bloomberg specifically mentioning Miami, where, you know, wages are going up. So people are looking for better jobs, right? And then prices go up. And then it's just this ugly cycle that inflation is feeding into.
Well, and a city like Miami is very, I would say, tourism and service business oriented, right? There's not a lot of factories in that area because it costs too much to build a factory there because the real estate's valuable. So there's this weird, I think, kind of like uneven rising of the dough as the yeast of, you know, stimulus sort of like pumps things up and the heat of the tension and of the economy kind of works with the yeast. You can't have everything in every area, right? Like you were saying, like you're not gonna have a coal plant in an area that there's no coal. And some people aren't gonna work in a coal plant or a coal power plant, I should say, or a coal mine if they don't have to, because they see that as a dirty job or as a hazardous job or something like that. We all remember the famous scene in Zoolander, right? Like, cut the black lung, Pop. So people want to have service jobs because they perceive them as very high quality, right? So there's these Instagram influencers and stuff that's like, oh, today I'm working, like I'll show you a day in a Meta employee, and they're going there like raiding the corporate kitchen and all this other stuff. It's like, well, yeah, when you let people LARP and they're not really working, and you know, in the service industry, like, yeah, you're gonna see massive swings in profitability or productivity or something like that. Whereas like back to what I was saying earlier, the goods-based stuff is very measurable. It's like, this is how many pounds of almonds your farm made. This is how many pounds of tomatoes your farm made. And that's either higher or lower than before. And there's a process associated with that. We tried this different watering schedule, we tried these different pipes, we lost less water this way, whatever, that way. So, you know, like that is more stable, right? It might not be as sexy, but it's probably like not flinging itself off the table. Whereas like hotel jobs or restaurant jobs in Miami, you know, you have to be really pretty, you have to, like, you know, to be the maitre d' of some famous place. So there's all these different weird esoteric requirements and aesthetic requirements that you have to measure up to. And then like the aesthetic falls out of favor, and then people literally lose everything. And that's what's so wacky to me, that people are relocating based on non-stable service jobs, as opposed to trying to work remotely and do remote service jobs or remote IT jobs or whatever, or do goods-based jobs. Because to me, remote work is more stable than the service industry, like in the way I'm thinking of it. And I think that's what people are gonna start to appreciate more. Maybe, like you said, the Swedish death cleansing.
Swedish death cleaning, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So as the economy sort of like pukes out all these, you know, these overpaid
zombie companies and zombie people,
zombie people that were sort of over hired or something like that. It's like, well, we like to have a certain culture, so we just have a lot of people working. Okay. So as that sort of wastefulness is sort of cast back out, those people might even get inspired to go work in a different industry or whatever. And, you know, eventually everything will get stronger as a result of that, right? Everything evolves in the economy to get stronger and more efficient because there's so much financial incentive to participate in that regard. So that's, so I think that's where the market sort of solves its own problem. So it's like whatever you puke out into the market will sort of digest it and, you know, like, I hate to say this, but like poop out like a better product later, you know, like it'll be better having gone through this pain. But the government manipulation of the money supply and the markets as a result of that, and people trying to play that, you know, if it's 75 bips, if it's 50 bips, this is going to happen. If it's 100 bips or 20 bips, this is what's going to happen. I just think that like, I think people are going to want to participate less in that and in that side of things and just say, hey, I just want to hold Bitcoin. I don't want to care about what Powell says. I don't want to care about Janet Yellen. I don't want to care about Christine Lagarde. I don't want to care about Augustin Carstens. Those guys, those people shouldn't have a way of manipulating my life and my success. So I'm going to hold my own sovereign money, you know, just everybody else be damned. But the thing that the reason why we can't do that yet is because there's no credit in the Bitcoin system that allows people to live the same lifestyle and preserve their lifestyle by living on a Bitcoin standard in that regard. And that's where I see that's a future, that's a potential future, but like how volatile is the road to get to that point, and how long will that take? Is that, you know, 20 years from now? Is it 5 years from now? I mean, it seems like it's further away.
I feel like we're getting closer for sure because of the circular economies that are starting, even if it's with stable coins, which some people have qualms about, I understand, but we're seeing a lot of just emerging markets use cryptocurrencies, digital assets in a circular economy sort of way, just opting out of their system entirely, right?
Yeah.
For us, it's a choice. For other people, it's life or death, you know, in emerging markets. Venezuela, any place, Turkey that has crazy inflation.
Right.
So that's, I don't know. That's all I have this week. I don't know if you got anything else.
Yeah. So I guess here's the question, right? So in the bigger they are, the harder they fall, right? The more you rely on credit, the more at risk you are of the credit market imploding either on top of you or underneath you and losing the thing that makes you money, right? The zombie companies, and I'll use MicroStrategy as a sort of you know thing, because this is what Saylor talks about. He's like, hey, listen, I didn't see that our company was going to be able to grow that much more, and there wasn't really anything we can invest in. You know, we couldn't go buy other companies and you know benefit from that leverage or something like that based on the niche that we're in. He's like, so I just bought a bunch of Bitcoin, and then I realized that, you know, by buying that Bitcoin, I was able to do XYZ. So his company sort of, and then people started buying MicroStrategy stock as a sort of like call option on Bitcoin in a way, mm-hmm. just same way they were buying GBTC for a while. So it's like, oh, anything Bitcoin related. And in bull market, the MicroStrategy valuation went back up again. Then he was able to sell shares, buy more Bitcoin, and kind of keep accelerating that process all the way up. Granted, like MicroStrategy stock is down from the top, Bitcoin's down from the top. But I do see more companies, like my company specifically, buying Bitcoin opportunistically with profits. Now that they're getting the accounting standards, you know, yeah, the FASB has sort of like lined things out a little bit, because now you can actually hold Bitcoin as an asset and not as a sort of
liability
as a liability, but like a time sensitive liability. If you hold it as a certain type of asset, like as a liquid asset, you don't have to depreciate it, right? But as a hard asset, you do, meaning like desks and chairs and computer systems and whatever. So if companies are incentivized to hold Bitcoin because it makes their balance sheet stronger instead of weaker, then you're going to see people try to manipulate the taxation aspect of buying and holding, or buying, holding, and writing down, you know, until that doesn't become viable anymore. And then it'll be instead of a buy, hold, and write down, it'll be a buy, hold, and use to lend against, you know, so creating your own credit worthiness, I guess. And that's where I can see things flipping and turning slowly and then clicking into place for big corporations to then be on a much more, let's say, even Bitcoin versus cash treasury situation? Because obviously a company like Apple that has a ton of cash could just go out there and buy $20 billion worth of Bitcoin, but they would be, they'd pump the market so much that their last Bitcoin would be priced probably double their first Bitcoin, or if not more.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of companies that are hesitant to buy Bitcoin as a result of them. They don't want to manipulate the price against themselves and then get dumped on from all, you know, from other people.
Right.
But if you see, like, if there's enough people that decide, I don't want to hold a central bank digital currency, I don't want to hold a fiat currency as the only currency in my corporate treasury, then I think that could make a big difference in the adoption rate. And there's companies like mine that give Bitcoin bonuses out, you know, to people on a small scale. So I think there's still so much room for American companies or just successful companies to spread Bitcoin. But for the regular people to buy Bitcoin, that comes out of their discretionary spending at this point still.
Right.
And it's not a core asset hold for them, you know, because some people, they're going to listen to Ray Dalio or, you know, Stanley Druckenmiller or whatever, talk about, oh, asset buckets and, you know, 5% this, 2% that, 10% this. They're like, yo, I got $150 in my savings account. What do I do? You know, and it's hard to tell those people to buy it. But if you're in Nigeria, you know, then you know that $150 worth of stuff you have in your savings account there could eventually be worth 10 cents because right. the government could just blow up the whole currency. So, yeah, in a way, there's like this kind of like this global sandwich of emerging markets having no other alternative, right? And then having the big corporations, successful corporations with too much money, say we can't just keep it all in dollars. It's sort of for the same reason, because no one knows what the fiat currency is going to be worth in 5 years. So it's almost like, hey, what's my risk here? I could have fiat currency and like I could go to Bitcoin or go hold some Bitcoin. And like, what's my risk? How much could we potentially lose? And then you have other people going like, my life is gonna, if I lose all of my hard work that I've accumulated over all these years, like how am I gonna live? And those are two super different motivations for buying Bitcoin.
And it's still early, you know? We say yeah. It's kind of jokingly, but it's only been 14 years since the white paper. It's been since 2009 that the network's been actually launched, and mm-hmm. it's had 99.98% uptime. So yeah. These things over time, you know, people age out of the CEO role, the CIO role, whatever role it is that makes these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And the newer generation comes up and sees this as more than just a, like an alternative asset, but like you're saying, potentially yeah. part of the balance sheet.
Yeah. Like, I mean, social media in terms of social networks has been around, let's call Friendster, I think was like 1999 or 2000 or something like that. So that's kind of, I think like social media in that regard is 20 years old. 22 years old specifically. So it's a little bit older than Bitcoin, you know, by just a touch. File sharing really was like the mid 90s, you know, Napster, then BitTorrent, that's like mid to late 90s. So file sharing is 25 years old, right? Let's call that. So we're still like, we were all born when we remember when those things started, but there's people being born now that won't know that those things ever started. They're just already operational, you know. It's like a mountain. It's like, oh yeah, the mountain was always there. That's the way.
Genie's out of the bottle. You can't.
Yeah, the genie's all the way out of the bottle. So while there could still be innovations that happen in the next couple years that like someone that's 15 years old today sees and says, wow, I remember when that happened and that thing clicked into place. But I like you said, if the people that are born into the fluency of that, because it's just happening already, then yeah, that is a huge wave of, that's a generational wave of adoption, because right. it's just normalcy, you know, the way like everybody's just has smartphones now. And some people don't remember when they had like the brick StarTAC, you know, Motorola phone or something like that. And then it went to Sidekick and then the iPhone and like the iPhone and then iPhone app stores and all these other things that happened. So I think we're still, We're not even at the iPhone of Bitcoin yet in that regard, you know. We're still a couple years away from the iPhone of Bitcoin.
There's still a lot of friction to onboard, to offboard, to use it anywhere utility wise. The people that are here understand that it's for them, for me, for you, it's a store of value in a certain way, but we are very far from from frictionless utility. You know, we're getting there. We're slowly getting there with Lightning and a few other things, but we're not where we need to be for sure.
I'm just glad that there's no Jerome Powell of Bitcoin saying like, hey, we're going to do this to the fees. Hey, we're going to do this. It's like, hey, you know, do it yourself. And I think that's great.
Well, it's just so black and white. It's like, there's a guy here pulling a lever in each country pulling a lever. And then there's math. Like, mm-hmm. What would you rather have? That's all it comes down to.
I'm trusting the rules and trusting the math. I'll go with math.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a good way to end it with a little bit of upswing positivity. Something to look forward to. Of course, it always is easier to look up when you're on the bottom. And if this is the bottom, then I'll feel pretty good about this being the bottom. If it turns out that is the case. I just think that we still have forward facing pain. There's still going to be pain coming through, but that's life. That's what they talk about in really every religion. They say, hey, you're not going to get through this without suffering. So you have to suffer with dignity. And that's kind of how we have to be in order to, I think, protect our future financially as well. So anyways, thanks to everybody for joining us on the Bitcoin Bottom Line, CJ Wilson and Josh Olsiewicz. You can follow us on Twitter at Bitcoin_pod and individually, Carpe Noctum, and I'm Straight Edge Racer. And if you have questions or complaints, feel free to let us know.